Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of October 21st, 2011. Dear Big Bank, it's not working out, so I'm leaving, and I'm taking all my money with me.
November 5th, I think, is just a really good goal deadline. It's definitely not intended to be a run on banks of hundreds of people storming in to close accounts and get their funds.
We talk with the founder of Bank Transfer Day. And if you're not so great at negotiating things like your salary, you can blame hormones.
The low testosterone people would try to convince the person to come up higher. The high testosterone person would be the one that would say, take the job and shove it and leave the room.
So I guess I got to take steroids before asking for that raise. And making smart decisions about your employee benefits can mean more money in your pocket.
Look at any exclusions and your total out-of-pocket expenses that you could pay or the coverage maximum. So know, you know, if you do end up needing more care, you won't be trapped.
An open enrollment checklist and more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM American Public Media.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
We've been talking for a few weeks now about the customer anger over new bank fees. In fact, we recently coached you through how to move your money, if that's what you decide to do. Well, this week we heard about Bank Transfer Day, a social media event created on Facebook that has garnered both attention and tens of thousands of fans. It sets aside November 5th as a day to move your money from a big bank to a smaller institution or a credit union. And it turns out the creator of Bank Transfer Day is an art gallery owner right here in L.A. So we met up with 27-year-old Kristen Christian at a quaint little coffee shop near our Los Angeles studios.
Hi.
Refill?
Yes.
Well, Kristen, thanks for meeting us here today.
Thank you.
Now, before we start, we were hoping originally to talk to you at your place of work. Tell us why you've decided that that's not a good idea at this point.
The movement has received a very significant response. Unfortunately, there are several websites that I cannot take down the address to my business, and we have had a couple of opponents who responded very strongly, and for my own personal safety, it'd be better to not be at that location.
What were they opposing?
I think the general fear is people will tuck their money under their mattress. That's definitely not what I'm encouraging. I'm encouraging a shift from a corporate level to a local level.
Well, take us back a couple of weeks ago to when you created an event on Facebook, and basically that was then publicized to your Facebook friends.
Mm-hmm.
What happened from there?
Well, I created the event, outlined to 500 of my friends why I was making the switch. The event currently has nearly 60,000 followers, and we've been growing by 5,000 to 10,000 a day.
What sparked this for you?
Well, after 13 years of abuse by Bank of America, everything from severe fees for a severe lack of services to having my funds frozen at any given moment, the final straw came when my former supervisor posted to his Facebook page as a status, Bank of America is charging $5.
And that was the $5 fee
the
for $5 debit
fee.
Cards.
Mm-hmm. Right. I don't tend to just believe what I read, so I did call a representative and spoke to them, asked them the exact details of this new fee structure, and was very disappointed, to say the least. At that point, I just began researching. When I found credit unions, I was floored. Lower rates, any fees to join usually go to charity. They really do make an effort to reinvest in local communities, both through charity and through offering low interest rate loans to independent citizens and small to medium sized businesses.
I know one of the questions that has been asked is whether this is tied to the Occupy Wall Street movement.
Absolutely, in no way. There's been a lot of confusion on that. While I do appreciate the enthusiasm that Occupy Wall Street has put into Bank Transfer Day, I don't personally condone the means of which they approach situations. I don't believe that people should go in large groups to banks to close their accounts, bringing signage and disrespecting the bank employees. Because when you opened your account, I know you didn't have signage and you spoke frankly and respectfully to the employee who assisted you.
How confident are you that Bank Transfer Day will actually result in action?
There is a likelihood that not every person who RSVPs will in fact move their money. In fact, I believe personally that many of the yes RSVPs are people who are already with credit unions. But at the end of the day, I started this event to educate my close circle of friends. So I definitely believe that any dollar transferred from the corporate level to the local level has the opportunity to make a significant positive impact.
What will you be doing on November 5th?
I've already established my credit union accounts. I actually will be moving my funds on November 4th. November 5th, I think, is just a really good goal deadline. It's definitely not intended to be a run on banks of hundreds of people storming in to close accounts to get their funds.
Well, Kristen, thank you so much for speaking with us.
And thank you.
Good luck on November 5th.
Thank you.
We wanted to get the banking industry's take on all this, so we called up Scott Talbot of the Financial Services Roundtable. He told us all these fees were predicted by the industry after the CARD Act was passed last year. And he said, if you are unhappy with fees being levied on your accounts, go ahead. Look for another bank. So we've just addressed the idea of shedding your bank. Now let's talk about shedding all those loser investments in your portfolio. Turns out it's a very difficult thing for us to do. Our brains are hardwired to resist. Jason Zweig wrote about this in a recent column in the Wall Street Journal. Welcome back.
Great to be with you, Tess.
Now, I have to say, you know, for the most part on this program, we talk to people about keeping their investments very simple, preferably in stock market index funds. So what we're talking about here when we talk about getting rid of losers, keeping winners, this is individual stocks, right?
Most likely that's the situation people are in, although I guess there could be cases where, you know, you have a loss on a diversified investment and you're struggling with the issue of whether to sell it.
Well, then let's take the first line of your article where you say taking a loss is hard to take, but avoiding a loss can be even worse. What does that mean?
Well, there certainly can be a tax benefit to people when they sell an investment for less than they paid for it, because you're allowed to write off your loss against your ordinary income. So a loss that you have on an investment, you can turn it into an asset.
Then why is it that people have been avoiding doing that? Is this a matter of being ever hopeful that that stock is going to come back?
Yeah, I mean, the way I like to think of it, Tess, if you buy a stock or a fund, and let's say you paid $50 for it, and now it's at $10, if you bail out now, you abandon all hope that it's ever going to get back to what you paid for it. Plus, you have to admit you made a mistake. But if you keep it, you can always tell the important people in your life, particularly yourself, you're not wrong. You just haven't been proven right yet.
We like to fool ourselves, right?
Hope springs eternal, especially in the human mind when we're making financial decisions.
Talk to us about what's wrong with that. You mentioned some research done at Emory University.
Yeah, there's a wonderful recent study that I got to see some of the results of. They had people lie inside a brain scanner while they were making decisions about whether to hold or sell an investment. And they found something that is quite surprising. This reward center of the brain did not have a significant response when the investment went up in price below the level people bought it. So you paid 50, it's at 10, it goes to 10.25, and you don't seem to be getting an internal reward signal in your brain. Hmm. It's as if you automatically expect it to go up. So when it does, it doesn't give you that thrill. And that may help explain why people hang on to losers.
But let's take the example, which I think is still fresh in a lot of people's minds, of March 2009, when, you know, stocks were at their lowest level in years. And a lot of people bailed. And within a year, the vast majority of them had recovered.
Yeah. Well, I guess there's a couple things I would point out. One is, in a situation like that, you can realize the tax benefit without making a call on the market. I mean, let's just go back to our simple numbers in our example. Mm-hmm. You paid 50, it's gone to 10, and now it's March 2009, and you're looking at it, and you've lost 80% of your money, you can sell the thing you paid 50 for at 10. You capture the tax benefit. But then you can take a second step. What you can do is you can immediately buy a very similar but not identical investment. You maintain your exposure, but instead of just merely selling low, you're also selling low and simultaneously buying low. You haven't taken a view on where the market is going in the future, but by buying something substantially similar, I'll maintain my exposure, and if the market does go up from here, then I'm still in it.
Jason Zweig writes the Intelligent Investor column for the Wall Street Journal, and we'd love to bring him on to talk about our brains on investing. Jason, thanks so much for coming in.
Great to be with you, Tess. Thanks.
And here's one more thing that many of us find hard to rid ourselves of: stuff. The possessions that accumulate over a lifetime, especially when they belonged to someone else, like your parents. Here's commentator Tim Bedore.
My chiropractor warned me, never help a friend pack up and clear out the house of an aging parent. But there I was, staring at a lifetime's worth of, depending upon your definition, either heavy stuff or heavy junk. And my friend had a finite period of time to get this house emptied and ready to sell. And we got to a defining moment, standing in the garage, looking at a Tom and Jerry bowl set, trying to figure out if this was a treasured family heirloom or dumpster material. If you don't know, a Tom and Jerry is a holiday season batter-top brandy rum drink, which our parents' generation believed you could not celebrate the holidays without. So my parents, his parents, they all had a giant bowl and 20 mugs with the words Tom and Jerry printed on them and ladled out these drinks to family and friends. And this Tom and Jerry set made very real the truism that time is money. My friend would have to go buy more boxes to wrap up those 20 mugs in a giant you could give a puppy a bath in it bowl, or quick hire a packing crew, that's more money, then store all this stuff in a rented storage space, more money, and store them until he realizes he'll never have a Tom and Jerry party because, well, when was the last time you were at one? Oh, he could keep the Tom and Jerry set and sell it later on eBay and make tens of dollars. Subtract the cost of the boxes and storage unit, well, not a reasonable option. And the dumpster he had rented was due to be picked up later that day. The clock was ticking. It was right there in the driveway. So I said, hearing 20 Tom and Jerry mugs crash in a dumpster might be fun. He knew I was right, but his head lost out to his heart. And he rented a storage space for those 20 mugs and more stuff like it, and has to square that all with his wife, which proves that when logical things like budgets have to be followed by emotional things like humans, well, that emotion thing is powerful stuff.
Tim Bedore is a stand-up comedian living in Minneapolis. Send us your thoughts. Write to us at marketplace.org/money or post on our Facebook page. This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it is time for your questions. Helping us out this week is our good friend David Lazarus, consumer columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Hi, David.
You say that in such a sing-song voice. It's so nice.
The Los Angeles Times. I wanted to ask you about a new survey that kind of relates to what we were talking about up top the show with Bank Transfer Day. Apparently, this survey showed that 30% of people said that they would leave their bank because of debit fees. And I guess my question is, if there is so much anger out there about these fees, why aren't more people doing it?
Right. So why isn't the number higher? And yeah, I would go so far as to say, I think the 30% number is even exaggerated. After this whole thing, the Bank of America $5 fee came out, and also it should be said, Wells is testing such a fee, Chase is testing such a fee. I got deluged, dozens and dozens of emails from people talking about how cheesed they were about this. And yet, when push comes to shove, not a lot of people said, I went and pulled the trigger and I switched banks. It's difficult, and the banks know that it is. And here's the dirty little secret: online bill pay. Once the banks got us all into online bill pay and those services, it's very hard to disentangle yourself from that. The banks did studies about this. They know that it makes you very monogamous, and it's difficult to transition, which makes me wonder whether there's some room for lawmakers to step up and make it easier for people to move their accounts from one online online entity to another, just as lawmakers had to step up to make it easier to move from one cell phone carrier to another.
But it's not that hard. I mean, I did it myself about, I don't know, a little less than 2 years ago. And, you know, it takes a couple of months. You have to make sure that you have money in one account and the other account so that all your bills get paid over time. But, you know, that's just a function of managing your money.
Yeah, but it's the hassle factor. And anyone who writes about consumer affairs knows that the hassle factor is a very big deal. One thing.
So are you saying we're lazy?
Not so much lazy as just, I think, intimidated. But in the survey that you just cited, when you parse it down a little bit, there's some really interesting numbers. For example, nearly half of all people making $50,000 a year or less say they're just going to take these fees on the chin, whereas only a small majority of people making $100,000 or more say that they're prepared to take these fees, which speaks to the idea that people with either more wealth or more sophistication when it comes to finance know that they have more options, whereas people seemingly, according to this survey, at the lower income levels, feel like they have less options. And I just want to say right here, you've got those options.
You're a consumer that, just like everybody else.
Yeah, exactly. And credit unions will welcome you with open arms. It doesn't matter what your income level is. So I think just because you tend to take things for granted when it comes to your relationship with your bank, that doesn't mean you are locked into a lifelong relationship with a financial institution.
Well, so there you go, folks. It is your choice. And trust me, you can do it. It is not that difficult. Let's go to the phones, and Suzanne is with us from Henderson, North Carolina. Hi there.
Hi.
You happy with your bank?
Yeah, I am. I actually just had that conversation with my teller yesterday.
Did you really?
Yeah. I wanted to make sure. I was with Wachovia, and they just got sold out to Wells Fargo. So
right.
Wells Fargo is also testing out a debit card fee. You know that, right?
I need to get more stable. I just moved. So I need to get more stable on my feet where I am before I make any drastic changes.
Uh-huh. So it was kind of a fact-finding mission for you, but you're going to stay put.
Yeah, for now.
Well, what do you do there?
I'm a teen parenting coordinator. I work with moms and dads that are teenagers in high school and helping them with parenting skills and personal skills.
And helping them stay in school and continue on?
Yes, sir.
Good for you. So what's the most important thing that you try to instill in those kids?
Just self-worth and respect for themselves and knowing that, you know, it's going to be hard work, but they can do it if they really put their mind to it.
It must be a hopeful thing to do then. I mean, you're catching these kids at a time when they're really having a tough go of it, and they need that help.
Yeah. You know, it's their choice on how much they want to get out of the program. But it is hopeful. You know, you see those babies, and who doesn't love babies?
not to pry too much, but how does somebody get into the teen parent counseling field? Is this something you have personal experience with?
Well, personal experience as in I had friends in high school, and I saw my life skills teachers, like, pull them in and give them the support they needed and the knowledge they needed. And that kind of motivated me to go into, like, a family consumer science field.
Hmm.
And then just kind of working with teenagers, I fell in love with them. So,
all right, what can we help you out with today?
Well, I wanted to talk to you. My organization has transferred from the 403B retirement fund into a mutual fund platform.
Okay, I'm going to stop you there just to explain that the 403B is what nonprofits use as sort of an equivalent for a 401k.
Basically the same. It's got a lot of the same ground rules as the 401k, but yeah, you're right. This is for nonprofits.
Yes.
So they're moving from a 403B to a what?
A mutual fund platform.
What did they tell you this was?
Well, I'm going to be honest. It happened when I was trying to get my program up and running for the school year.
Uh-huh.
So I was getting like a million emails, and it was just one of those emails that just got pushed off to the wayside.
Sure, and that happens.
I don't really understand financial jargon, so okay, whatever. I mean, you're the person in my organization that knows the stuff, so if that's what we're doing, okay.
All right, Suzanne, clearly your first step, obviously, is to understand what this quote-unquote mutual fund platform is, whether they're going to be moving you out of something that works in your favor as a 403B or a 401K does, because you're going to get tax benefits from that and maybe even a match from your employer if you're lucky. Contact HR and say, define your terms. Where is it based? Is it going to be based with, you know, Fidelity or Schwab? Will they be picking where the investments are? Will you have to pick through? Are you beeping, Suzanne?
sorry. I'm in school, and so that was the lunch bell.
Oh, okay. Well, do we know what's for lunch today?
I don't know what's for lunch today.
Okay. Well, when people beep, I always get concerned. You know, you never know, right?
It
could be the Terminator. I don't know. So anyway, you clearly want to just be savvy about why the company or the employer is doing this. But I think even more to the point, Suzanne, it sounds like you're finally getting a little savvier about your retirement because you're thinking about this money, where it's going, and what it's going to be doing for you. And from the bigger picture, that's definitely something that when you're not paying attention to the needs of teen parents is something that you do want to pay attention to for your own needs.
Okay.
Okay. Let us know how it goes.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And next, we're joined by Wendell in Rochester, New York. Hi there.
Hello. How are you?
Very well. What do you do there in Rochester?
I'm an attorney. I do patent law, patent litigation.
So you're not an evil attorney?
No, I'm not.
Oh, so, well, good for you.
David, you got any inventions that you've been wanting to run by somebody?
I wish I was like Ron Popeil and I could be spurting this stuff out of the pocket fisherman. You know, how great was the pocket fisherman?
I bet you have people coming up to you with invention ideas all the time, don't they?
Well, it happens sometimes, family members and friends. You know, you can look it up pretty quickly online and figure out if you have a new idea or not.
Really? Is it that easy?
Yeah. I mean, you can often, you'll have someone who's a potential inventor will just simply refer them to looking on Google or go to the patent office website and do your own search because, you know, the inventor knows their own invention and they can often figure out if someone's already come forward with that idea and tried to patent it.
Wendell, there's been a lot of talk about reforming the patent system. It's been said to be archaic and very clunky. What do you think?
Yeah, well, there were some big changes that occurred. The Patent Reform Act was signed into law last month, and probably the biggest change was this first-to-file system, which harmonizes the United States with the rest of the world and saying instead of the first person to invent the invention gets the patent, it now goes to the first person to file the patent application.
That doesn't seem fair. It seems like the person who invented it should get it, not the first person to file.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who prefer the U.S. system as it was. But then again, you could have people who are sitting on inventions that could help others in their inventive process. And so you want to get that information out there.
Huh.
If you give people the incentive to make your filing now, it kind of helps others spur on their invention.
Well, so when I come up with my multi-million-dollar invention, I'm going to give you a call.
Certainly. That'd be great.
Okay.
Well, I'd like a little taste of that.
Nope. Sorry. All mine. unless you file before I do, before I get to it.
I'm out of here. See you, Tess. Thanks for having me.
All right. So how can we help you with the invention of money management?
Well, my question actually goes specifically to me. It's about a student loan, but I guess it pertains generally to personal debt. I have one last student loan, and it's on an extended payment plan and has a variable rate that's tied to prime.
So it's a private loan?
Well, it's actually my wife's loan. I think it originally was private.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, the rate currently is 2.11%. So
wow. Nice.
I have, you know, it's really great. And I have money right now where I could put more toward paying off the loan, but it seems more advisable to invest that money since the rate is so low. But at some point further down the road, I may wish that I had paid it off when the rates go back up. And so I guess that's the question is, like, is there a rule of thumb as to, you know, paying off such a loan that has a variable rate? Do I want to take now and invest my money and when the rate goes back up, then put money toward the loan? Or should I be trying to just clear the debt as soon as possible, like a lot of the, you know, books and websites advise you to do?
And radio shows.
Exactly.
How much of a monkey is this on your back?
Oh, it's not much. I mean, it's itself is fairly sizable, but the monthly payments are completely manageable. So,
yeah, here's a couple of interesting factoids. Last year, $100 billion, that's a record, in new student loans was issued. And this year, $1 trillion in student loans will be outstanding in the United States. That's more money than Americans owe on their credit cards. I think, Wendell, right out of the gate, the rule of thumb that you cited before is still the right one. And that is when you've got a variable rate and it's very, very low, it kind of makes more sense to make the minimum payments there and then use the money elsewhere. But at the same time, people who've heard me more than once know that I'm a real debt hawk, and I don't like debt. And so I always advocate if you can pay things off, do pay it off, because that's just one less storm cloud on the horizon.
Okay.
Does that help you out?
It sure does. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for the call, Wendell.
One quick question. What area of inventions do you think has the most opportunity for a guy like me who wants to, you know,
David is fishing.
I'm fishing, exactly. Should I be thinking tech? Should I be thinking household products? I mean, where?
Well, try to get the thing that appeals to most people. Like just in the business model, the wider the spread is in the market, the more you'll make in the end.
The better mousetrap.
Exactly.
All right. Thanks for the call, Wendell.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Yeah, I've been thinking about a sort of, it's like a computer, but instead of pressing keyboards, you would touch the screen. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, David, that's a really original idea.
So you could, like,
brilliant.
Touch it and interact with it, tactile.
You know what my better mousetrap is?
What?
Two cats.
or three cats.
All right, let's go to Manny now. And wow, he is in Kodiak, Alaska. Hi, Manny.
Hey, how are y'all doing?
Very well. I have to say, I think this is our first call from Kodiak. Are you a native Alaskan?
No, I actually moved here 4 months ago, and I'm traveling on business in Kodiak. I'm live in Anchorage right now.
Got to ask, how's the weather?
It's not bad. It's in the 30s, which...
It's not bad. It's in the 30s?
Which
You're
I'm
talking
learning.
To two people in Los Angeles here. Are you kidding me?
I'm from Georgia, so I know how odd it sounds, but it could be worse. It could be worse.
Great.
Well, are you liking it there?
Yeah, it's a different experience.
What do you do?
I work for a telecom company. I sell, I guess, telecom to state and local government in Alaska.
Are there any unusual things in Alaska because of the huge footprint of the place?
Oh, yeah. We're the only place in the nation that has, you know, a dedicated satellite for the state.
What?
I didn't know that.
So we launch our own satellite so that people can stay connected in the villages, which is great.
That is awesome.
There's an Alaska sat up there?
Yeah, there
Who
is.
Who knew?
All right. So how can we help you out there in Alaska today?
I'm fairly young. I'm 23.
You are the master of understatement. I'm fairly young. I'm 23. It's pretty good out here. It's in the 30s.
I'm just bracing myself for winter. I haven't been through a winter, so I have to be optimistic.
Okay,
yeah, we'll talk again later. Yeah.
All right. So you're 23.
So I just graduated from college about 3 years ago. When I was in college, I went into a lot of debt.
Uh-oh.
And basically defaulted on a loan. One of my credit card companies took me to court, so we had to settle. And now I'm trying to dig out of that hole. Even though I have a decent job, I can't use the money that I have the way I want to just because I can't get accepted for a credit card. I can't get a loan for a house.
Right.
So I guess the question is, how do you build credit quickly?
Couple of questions. How deep in the hole were you?
Other than student loans, my student loans are about $50,000. Credit card loans and, you know, everything else, we're talking about maybe $10,000.
And you racked that up during college?
Yeah, okay. Basically.
All right. Well, Manny, I've certainly heard far worse horror stories than $10,000. So, you know, that's okay right there. Have you paid it all off, or do you have a repayment plan now in the works?
Everything is paid off, but it's still on the credit report as
Oh, yeah.
And that'll be
there
for years.
That'll be there for 7 years.
Yeah.
And there's no way to remove that.
Nope.
Well, 7 years, and then it goes adios. But you're right. It's having a big black mark on your credit score. But I am here to tell you that now that you've put your scofflaw ways behind you, you can rebuild your credit score. I deal with this a lot. A lot of people come to me, especially in this economy.
Yep.
And the simple fact is what the banks, what lenders want to see is that you have seized control of your financial life and that you are showing a more responsible pattern. You get one piece of plastic, let's say, whether it's a major credit card or a store credit card, and you carry your balance on it, you pay it off every single month, and you use it like that responsibly, over time, you will develop and demonstrate a pattern of responsible money management, which is exactly what lenders want to see.
But David, my guess is that, I mean, right now, Manny, have you looked at trying to get a credit card? You probably can't get one, right?
Right. I actually took about a year and a half off and started just, you know, making payments consistently on everything I have.
Like your student loans and rent and all that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's still, when I applied about a month ago, they still denied me. They offered me a secured credit card.
I was just going to tell you that.
About those.
No. That's where you basically give them money
that they then put on a card, and you can then use that up to the limit of whatever money that you have given them. It's basically like a prepaid credit card that you do. Do you know what your credit score is?
Yeah, it is 560.
560, okay.
You got to drag that back up. If you can get it up into the high 700s, you've done yourself a big favor.
Yes, that's the goal.
The key thing here is make your payments. That's all creditors care about. That's what they're watching for. They want to see that this is somebody who can pay back his loans. As long as you're that guy, they're going to want to do business with you.
All right. Well, thanks for the answers.
Good luck, Manny.
Well, thank you.
All right. Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, and we spell that M-O-N-Y, or you can send us an email. You can do that with the Getting Personal link at our website. It is marketplace.org. David, so great to see you. Thanks for the advice.
That was fun.
And do remember to always check with your own financial professional before you make any big money decisions.
And on my idea, you'd be able to tap on icons, right?
Yeah.
And things would happen.
And maybe like other companies could create some
applications. And they'd give,
like,
me, part, and they'd give me part of their money because it would be a high thing.
Because of your giant wallet, just get rid of it. Never. It is a part of me.
I'm Lisa Putney, and I'm from Chattanooga, Tennessee. We're at Bon Appetit. It's a gourmet pet bakery and boutique. Let's see. Of course, I have money and credit cards, gift cards. I have sizes for my dogs. I have 4 Bostons and 1 Pug. The sizes are mainly for collars and apparel. I have that in there. That's a little weird. Well, they all have sweaters, and they all have T-shirts. They all wear Tennessee jerseys. They can't wait to put their clothes on. Only one gets embarrassed that is not real crazy about putting their clothes on.
This is Marketplace Money from APM American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and I am a terrible negotiator. Just awful. If there is bargaining to be done of any kind, whether at the car lot or in the boss's office, forget it. How about you? Are you a haggler? Are you a pushover? Well, if you are not sure, check your hormones. A new study says it's our chemistry that determines what kind of dealmakers we are. And some of us may just want to consider steroid creams before our next salary negotiation. I joke, I kid. Kind of. Sally Herships has our story.
Christine Porath teaches business at Georgetown. She told me about a personal assistant who asked her boss for a raise. The negotiation didn't go so well. Her boss only offered a tiny fraction of what the assistant asked for.
She just felt like it was a ridiculous amount, given her workload and the boss's extraordinary demands.
Her boss was one of those high-performing, high-energy CEOs, and the job was tough. But Pora says the personal assistant got so angry over what she thought was an unfair salary offer, she decided to get revenge. The assistant badmouthed her boss to her coworkers and even left a receipt for the boss's expensive lingerie next to the fax machine.
And this is the same pattern we've seen in our research. People that feel like they're disrespected find ways to get even.
But the personal assistant repeatedly tried to sabotage her boss. Who does that? People with lots of testosterone. High levels of the male hormone is what makes people retaliate when they perceive an offer as unfair. Imagine you're in a job interview and you get a salary offer that you think is way too low.
The low testosterone people would try to convince the person to come up higher. The high testosterone person would be the one that would say, take the job and shove it and leave the room.
Adam Galinsky is a professor at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management. He's a co-author of a new study on the effect of testosterone on negotiations.
So this idea is that everyone recognizes this is unfair, but only the people that are high in testosterone are going to aggressively respond to that unfairness.
Pretend I had a high level of testosterone. Here's how I might respond to my editor, John Haas' suggestion. Hey, John, so here's how I want to start my story. Once upon a time, in a corporation far, far away, there was a grumpy personal assistant.
Yeah, Sally, I don't think the fairy tale thing is really working.
Are you kidding me?
I'm not sure this was your best idea.
If you don't let me keep that in, you can find someone else to file this story.
Come on, Sally.
The surprising thing is, while we often associate testosterone with strength, Galinsky says people with high testosterone are actually really sensitive. They care a lot about respect. And in the world of business, respect often translates into money.
Absolutely. So think about a salary. What does a salary tell you? A salary has a functional utility. It allows you to rent an apartment or buy a car, but it also has a psychological utility. It says, my salary tells me how much the organization respects me.
So does more testosterone mean you're better at making deals? Galinsky says it makes you more aggressive. That can be a big help for one-time negotiations. But if you're haggling over a contract, which requires lots of little issues, it could keep you from reaching a deal at all. So what's a negotiator to do? I asked professional negotiator Jeff Gordon for some tips.
Number one is ask, don't tell.
Gordon says ask the other side what they perceive as a good offer. What do they want out of this negotiation anyway?
Number two, control your own emotional response.
Escalating things isn't going to get you a better deal. It's just going to make you lose your cool. And number three is to know your walkaway point. Always figure out what you'll be left with if you don't accept the current terms. But Gordon says negotiators also need to know their ZOPA, the zone of possible agreement. It means knowing what each side is willing to accept.
If those two ZOPAs do not overlap, you will never have a deal.
Using that info, the high testosterone Sally from my earlier example realized she wanted to get this piece on the air. So she cut a deal with her editor, John.
Hey, Sally, nice piece.
Yeah, but it would have been nice to use my fairy tale metaphor.
Let's just agree that this is a happy ending.
Ooh, so can I play the fairy tale music now?
Okay, yeah, sure.
From the magical world of Radioland, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace Money.
Take a deep breath. The smell of fall is in the air. Apple cider and pie, wet leaves, open enrollment. Okay, so that doesn't smell. But some employees are already getting a whiff of it as the season of picking benefit plans swings into gear. If you're not exactly looking forward to going through health plans, there are some ways to streamline the process and save some money. Kimberly Lankford is here to tell us about those. She's with Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine and wrote about open enrollment recently. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So 2014 is, believe it or not, just around the corner, which, of course, is the year that the Health Reform Act is set to take effect. Are we going to see any changes this year during open enrollment in anticipation of that overhaul?
Well, the changes are much more incremental. Last year, for example, the children up to age 26 could be covered by their parents' policy. And also, most plans had to start covering preventive benefits, no matter what size deductible you had, which helped a lot of people last year, added a little bit to the costs overall. But most of the things are gradual that you'll see in the next few years.
Okay. Well, one thing that never seems to be gradual is that costs just keep going up and up and up, and certainly continue to do so. Where are consumers likely to feel that pinch this year?
Well, you'll feel it in a bunch of different places. First of all, in premiums. The Kaiser Family Foundation came out with their numbers for the increases over 2011, and is a 9% increase over the previous year. So the total cost of family coverage is now $15,073 on average.
Ooh.
And for employee-only coverage is $5,429. Now, the interesting thing is employees continue to get a lot of subsidy from their employer, but they are starting to pay more. And especially for the family coverage. But for large firms, a lot of them are providing a much bigger subsidy for the families than the small employers are. So if one spouse works for a large firm, another spouse works for a small firm, take a look at what those overall costs are for your family, because it could be vast differences depending on what they're charging for the rest of the family.
It really pays to compare those plans, then sit down and perhaps have a financial date night to do that.
Exactly. And this fall, that's the key thing to do. The other important thing to look at is the other out-of-pocket expenses that you have. One thing that a lot of employers are doing is switching from fixed dollar copays to percentage coinsurance rates. So instead of paying, you know, $10 or $20 for each doctor's visit, you're starting to have to pay maybe 20% for preferred doctors, 30% for non-preferred doctors. And if your doctor charges a lot, you're going to be paying a lot more out of your pocket than you had been in the past. So that's kind of a hidden way that a lot of employers are increasing the costs. Another key thing is you may be offered life insurance through your employer, which can be a great deal if you have medical conditions, because a lot of times they'll give you a set amount for free and then they'll let you buy extra coverage on your own, which can be great. It can help you think about the need for extra coverage. But if you're healthy, you may be able to find a better deal on your own for buying your own life insurance rather than just adding on that extra coverage through your employer.
You know, anytime I hear someone talk about making a choice of whether to prepare for catastrophic coverage, I'd like to see the person who can actually predict that they're going to be in a catastrophe, right?
And that's the reason why you have insurance, is you have no idea what's going to happen to your health. So it is really important, if you do have a high deductible plan, for example, have a plan for where that money's going to come from if you happen to have that many medical expenses. The one good thing is, as more employers are offering high deductible plans, they're keeping those premiums pretty low. It can be a good deal. And they're also helping to contribute money to people's health savings accounts. And that can be great. Be sure to contribute as much as you can afford to a health savings account if you have a high deductible plan, because it gives you a triple tax benefit. The money goes in pre-tax, the money grows tax deferred, and then you can use it tax-free for your medical expenses. And if you don't, if you're healthy, that money can grow for the future. You can use it in any year. It's not use it or lose it like FSAs.
An FSA, of course, being a flexible spending account.
Also look at any exclusions and your total out-of-pocket expenses that you could pay, or the coverage maximum. So no, you know, if you do end up needing more care, you won't be trapped. And any of those tools can really help, because right now it is just so difficult to compare. Sometimes it just looks apples to oranges.
Exactly. Math is fun.
Math is important during open enrollment.
Kimberly Langford is a contributing editor for Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine. Thank you so much for coming in.
Well, thank you for having me.
And before we leave the topic of healthcare, we wanted to note an event that's taking place here in Los Angeles this weekend. The nonprofit Care Now has been here before. They set up at a local sports arena and provide free medical care to thousands of people in a four-day period. Some of the patients this week are among the 50 million in America who do not have health insurance. But Marketplace's Jennifer Collins found that many who show up do have it, but are not covered for all the care they need.
Los Angeles resident Natasha Reese has been waiting to get her teeth checked for weeks.
I bit down on something one day and a filler came out, so I've been dealing with excruciating pain day and night. I've been popping ibuprofen like candy.
Then she found out about the free clinic that offers medical, vision, and dental care.
I heard about this and I've been anticipating a day.
Reese has been without a job for a couple of years. She does have California's version of Medicaid, but that doesn't cover her dental. Another patient, 49-year-old Servando Medrano, lost his insurance when he was laid off a year ago. Last week, he was bitten by a spider.
My leg got all swollen up and pus was coming out. I went to the emergency. That's when they charged me $500 for 30 minutes.
Now he needs a follow-up. As the clinic's doors opened Thursday, patients got restless and rushed the gate. Security for the event got out the megaphones.
I guarantee that everybody on this line will be taken care of.
The nonprofit Care Now operates the clinic with hundreds of volunteers. Founder Don Minnelli says for about $300,000, the clinic will serve nearly 5,000 people this weekend. About half will likely have some kind of medical coverage. But that doesn't mean they can always get into a doctor.
The local clinics are absolutely slammed on dental patients. I think it's like a 5 or 6 month wait or something. If you got a toothache, that's a long time to wait.
Those long waits may not get better, despite federal health care reform. Glenn Melnick is a health economist at USC.
Even after the law comes online and people get covered, if you were to open up a free clinic, you would get thousands of people lined up, in part because the waiting times to see doctors is going to grow.
Go sit in those bleachers. They'll call you by your number.
Inside the Los Angeles sports arena, more patients came in for triage for everything from bad vision to poor circulation. But the biggest need? Dental. 61-year-old Marcia Jones was a security guard who's now on disability.
I hope that I can get some teeth put in back in my mouth, okay?
Wait, so you said you don't have teeth?
No, no teeth.
Clinic organizers say there's good news for her. several Los Angeles doctor's offices are offering follow-up care, in some cases, for free. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace Money.
It is college application season for high school seniors. Unlike shopping for, say, a computer or a dress, it's almost impossible to know how much college will really cost until pretty late in the game, as in next spring. But by the end of this month, colleges will be required to have a net price calculator on their websites. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Amy Scott explains.
In a basement room at Goucher College outside Baltimore, staffers gather around a projector. On the screen in front of them is the template for the college's new net price calculator. It'll run on the school's website. Michael O'Leary, Vice President for Enrollment Management, is overseeing the project.
This is what the product will look like to the user. Okay.
They type in some information for a hypothetical student: marital status, family income, SAT scores, and the calculator spits out a number. What that student can expect to pay to attend the private liberal arts school, tuition and fees, books and room and board, after you subtract grants and scholarships. They're struggling to get that number right.
In this example, we've got a family income of $50,000 and an expected contribution of $13,000. That doesn't sound totally realistic to me in terms of that family's ability.
A lot of prospective students might look at Goucher's sticker price of $49,000 a year and assume they can't afford it. But O'Leary says the average freshman gets thousands of dollars in financial aid from the school.
Ideally, we don't want any student to be turned away by a sticker price because we might be the ideal place for that student.
It's terrifically important that people understand net price versus sticker price.
That's higher education policy analyst Sandy Baum. I talked to her recently at an event on the cost of college. She says the new net price calculators are meant to expand access to college.
People are very discouraged from applying to schools that have high sticker prices, and we do have to get them to understand that that's not the price they pay.
Some calculators will get closer to the real price than others. Lauren Asher is president of the nonprofit Institute for College Access and Success. She says colleges have a lot of leeway in how they set up their calculators. Some will require just a few basic details. For others, you'll need to dig up bank and tax records.
We did find some calculators that require more than 40 pieces of information, including detailed financial records.
That may get you a pretty accurate estimate, but Asher says a lot of people might give up before they get there. They're more likely to stick with a simple calculator.
A rough estimate at least tells you whether you're in the right ballpark, and that's a crucial starting point.
At Goucher, officials opted for a more detailed version. They're worried about students getting one number from the calculator before they apply and a very different number when they actually get in. Goucher's Michael O'Leary says a lot can change from, say, junior year when you start shopping around to spring of senior year. Grades, your family finances.
The bottom line, however, won't come typically until April, when the student has the offer of admission and the offer of financial assistance in hand. That's when the true comparison can take place, April of their senior year.
Which sort of leaves us right back where we started. All the net price calculators will come with a big disclaimer. All they give you is an estimate. O'Leary says the more thorough the information students and parents provide, the better the estimate will be. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace Money.
On our Making Money blog, Mark Kantrowitz, publisher of two financial aid websites, weighs in on the value of these net price calculators. And finally, to this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award. Our little blue plastic friend is heading to New York City and the headquarters of the Girl Scouts of America. Not because Piggy needs more cookies. He most certainly does not, the little blue porker. But the Girl Scouts recently redesigned their badges, and there are some new categories that caught our attention. Good credit, budgeting, money manager, and financing my future. Piggy and I are squealing with delight to see money skills as an important part of every girl's toolkit. So, your highest achievement is the Girl Scout Gold Award. Ours is a blue plastic pig. Now, he's on his way to Manhattan, but we'd really love to hear from some local chapters about how you're going about earning these badges. So send us your stories. And while you're at it, maybe send some cookies? Samoas for me and Steven, Do-Si-Dos for Devin, Thin Mints for John, and Trefoils for Deb. You know, if you just happen to have some lying around. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. You can friend us and me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time, who doesn't love credit? It's the getting into debt part that's the problem.
Throughout human history, people have tried to reconcile two completely irreconcilable ideas. Morality is paying your debts. Money lenders are evil.
Marketplace Money is produced by John Haas with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.